From KALW and PRX, this is Inflection Point, stories of how women rise up. I'm Lauren Schiller. Every day, millions of Americans tune in to Fox News for their daily dose of divisive rhetoric.
I'm asking you a very crisp question.
Earlier this week, you take people off the air when you don't like what they're saying. Tucker Carlson falsehoods. The same thing
this
that
is
he
just,
was
this
doing.
This is just stupid, Kurt. I'm sorry. Nobody's getting anything out of this. I'm asking you a plain question. You're not answering, filibustering.
And many of us associate the female newscasters of Fox with their signature Fox makeovers.
So what, crucify me if I'm being, you know, awful to other women? I'm not. It's their choice. You know, if you want to dress up in a, you know, plum-colored sheath dress, you know, with massive chicken fillet bras, go for it. But I'm not doing it.
In fact, when I was doing research for this episode, I discovered a particularly telling quote about being a woman at Fox News. That it was akin to being a stripper.
Roger said that. He said we got the same woman but shinier poles.
That Roger would be Roger Ailes, former chairman and CEO of Fox News. Ailes is credited with making media careers, Sean Hannity, Glenn Beck, Bill O'Reilly, and breaking careers.
It was awful. I'm in the back of the car with this guy, and he's making this pass at me, and I've admired him, and it's come out of nowhere, and it's full on, and it's vulgar, and it's explicit, and he's got me alone, and like I don't want to like create a scene or a tussle or like have to fight him off in the back seat. So it's pretty bad. But then she gets out of the car and she goes, "Oh, thank God, that's over with. I never have to see him again." Where it then gets so dark is that he calls up the people that she is interviewing with and says, you know, she's on a do not hire list.
And making presidents, Nixon, Reagan, George H.W. Bush, Trump.
You know, Donald served Roger Ailes very well in terms of his ratings. And, you know, Roger served Donald Trump incredibly well because he gave him a platform.
How did this man get so much power? And how did he get away with so much harassment for so long?
It's all about money. You know, if you're making a lot of money, people don't want to rock the boat. So they will make excuses for you, or they will look the other way, or they'll create sort of institutional firewalls that, you know, prevent you having oversight by another department or by another group of people so that nobody has to know, sort of thing.
Ailes died in 2017, but his legacy of bringing fear and uncertainty to our country lives on.
It's just funny that Donald and Roger, they have these similar sort of embodiments, you know, the bombast, the kind of sexual barbarism.
This is Inflection Point. I'm Lauren Schiller. You might be wondering at this point why in the world I would want to devote an episode to Roger Ailes. Well, not only was he one of the worst perpetrators of sexual harassment, but because of his place in media and his effect on media, he's arguably changed the course of our country. But what really interested me is what perspective a woman filmmaker would bring to his story. Alexis Bloom is the director of a new documentary called Divide and Conquer, The Story of Roger Ailes.
I don't believe anyone will ever be elected to a major public office again without the skillful use of television.
Roger Ailes.
Roger Ailes.
Roger Ailes.
Roger Ailes, the most powerful man in media.
I was looking back at the history of your work, at the body of work that preceded the making of Divide and Conquer, the story of Roger Ailes. And I was just curious if you would consider yourself as having a theme to your work or something that you're trying to accomplish with each piece that you work on.
There isn't a theme to my work. I will work on anything that's intriguing. I feel like, you know, there's so many interesting things out there in the world, and being given the opportunity to understand something new is such a privilege. for me, you know, the gate is wide open. I mean, I'm interested in humanity in all its guises. I guess I don't do animals, put it that way. I don't do the secret life of hamsters.
So in reading a little bit about your background, my understanding is that you went to the journalism school at UC Berkeley.
That's right, yeah.
And that your first project was about the arrival of television in Bhutan.
Oh, my God, you have done your research. This is astounding. Way back in 1804. Yes, I did. That's true. You're right.
Well, it intrigued me because of the film that you've just made is about the impact of television on our broader community, really. And so I just thought that would be an interesting thing for us to talk about, like what you learned when you went and did that project and if any of that has stayed with you.
Yes, it has. And in fact, you're the first person to ever notice the sort of the complementary oeuvre, you know, the first book and the most recent book. But you know what it taught me? It was a student film. It was a thesis film that I did at the journalism school at Berkeley, which, by the way, is a fantastic journalism school. And it has a great documentary film program. But it was about the arrival of television in Bhutan, which, you know, prior to that had been sort of the last pristine Petri dish, you know, completely TV-free, advertising-free. And this was in 1999. And it was amazing to see how entranced people got with television and how quickly, and the sorts of things that they loved were, the first thing that springs to mind is the WWF, the World Wrestling Federation, not the World Wildlife Federation.
No animals.
And they loved the fights, you know, between good and evil, basically, you know, between these sort of like very cartoonish battles between different characters in tights. And there's not, you know, there's an element to Fox that's similar, you know, this kind of great gladiatorial spectacle, the conflict.
Yeah, that is definitely a theme that runs through this film and is frankly running through this country. And it seems like what you bring to life in the film is that it was in large part fueled by Fox News and Roger Ailes in particular, throwing gasoline on that fire.
Roger's a fascinating character. I mean, just as far as personalities and people go, he's fascinating. He's bombastic and ambitious and thuggish, but he's also very vulnerable and kind of fragile. He's a psychological sort of paradox in many ways, and I wanted to understand that. I also wanted to understand his influence on America, you know, in a much more macro, big picture way. You know, he has changed America. He has changed the landscape we live in. We live in Roger's world to some degree. And understanding his own life was a way of understanding contemporary American politics.
I read that when you were first talking with people about the project, that not that many people were familiar with his name, which I found interesting because I feel like the second I saw Roger Ailes, I immediately had like a physical reaction and I knew exactly who you were talking about. But I'm curious about that group that didn't know who he is, and then maybe for them it would be useful to have you just give a little bit of a bio on Roger Ailes.
Yeah, I mean, so many people don't know who Roger Ailes is, also interestingly enough, they're about to really know who he is because there's two Hollywood projects coming down the pike. You know, he's about to be played by Russell Crowe on the one hand and John Lithgow on the other. So believe me, he'll become a household name. But, you know, when you make films, they take ages. You go about your life. I drop my kids off at school and talk to other parents and they say, what are you working on? And this is, you know, Brooklyn, pretty well-read, generally, you know, engaged community. And many people were like, who? When I said Roger Ailes. Or I'd go out, you know, into the country working on like other small gigs that I had, you know, and talk to people, you know, in middle America, and they wouldn't know as well. And they might have been Fox viewers and they wouldn't know who he is. It just, he was somebody who was behind the scenes. I feel like he had a show on briefly. He had a network called America's Talking for a couple of years. And on that network, he had his own show where he did the interviews. But pretty much he was a behind the scenes person. And, you know, I don't know, there's so much to digest and to see and read and hear in life. I feel like, you know, unless you're sort of Kim Kardashian, you know, you fall off the radar. It was gobsmacking to me that people didn't know, but more people didn't know than did know. And then if they did know who he was, they were like, oh, yeah. That guy who got done for sexual harassment, oh yeah. And I'd have to explain that, yes, he did get done for sexual harassment, but he also had a decades, you know, career in political campaigning, that he had been influential in the election of Richard Nixon, Reagan, George H.W. Bush. You know, he had very deep political roots in this country and had sort of parlayed that into the world of entertainment to make this kind of heady sort of gladiatorial spectacle that is Fox News. And that's my way of describing him.
Well, when you went into it, what story did you think you were going to tell? And is that what you ended up telling?
I don't have a very sort of circumscribed sense of the story I'm going to tell when I start. I think about it like I have an idea of the parable, you know, the beats, the emotional beats, and you know, parables are transferable across cultures and languages, and sometimes they differ, you know, in the characters that appear or the things people say, but the end result is sort of the same. And I had a feeling for the parable of Roger Ailes, that he was this kind of dark and ambitious impresario, you know. Some call him a genius who had created this monstrously successful company, knowing the emotional landscape of Americans in intimate detail. He had sort of built his empire on the sort of the emotional skin, the mountains and the sort of valleys of America. He was somebody unlike any other television executive. And I knew he was special and that he came from an extraordinary place, and that he'd been upended by his own desires, basically, his own desire for power, for women, for ambition. So it's sort of almost, you know, kind of Shakespearean in some sense. But then, you know, so many things surprise you along the way.
What was something that surprised you?
I mean, how paranoid he really was. You know, I knew that he was sort of thuggish, but I didn't know that he genuinely thought that you know, Obama was going to come and get him using the TSA. God knows why the TSA. I always think, like, whenever I go through
scenario.
I go through airport security, you know, and when someone's surly to you, and in JFK, they're overworked and there's just too many people, and you often get sort of pushed around a little bit. And I always think to myself, oh, this is where Roger gets it from. You know, he went through security and was like, oh, they're out to get me.
I think we all feel that way.
But, you know, he was deeply paranoid. I was also surprised by the extent, you know, mostly surprised by the cover-up. That's what really got to me. You know, how many people covered up for Roger Ailes? How many people facilitated him? And it's fascinating to look at that cast of characters, you know, and many of them are women. It's definitely not like a penis-related thing. It's his secretary, you know, who was with him for decades, who he had an affair with. She was his mistress. And then she stayed with him, you know, through George H.W. Bush, through his consultancy days, through America's Talking, through Fox. His legal counsel, who sort of covered up, you know, when women came into Fox and said, you know, I've had this sexual harassment issue, she looked at them and said, when's your contract up? You know, there's it takes like a whole machine of people to keep a business going. And they're all dedicated to sort of stamping out, you know, things that are potentially damaging. And they did that for years with Roger and with Bill O'Reilly.
Well, it was really fascinating to listen to the stories of the crisis communication team that was brought in towards the end of that,
they're great.
Of the accusations. And I kept wondering, why are they speaking so freely? And then they revealed that they hadn't been paid, there was no contract, there was no NDA, and they really just wanted to do the right thing. Fascinating, a man and a woman.
It took me ages. It took me a year, you know, to get them on board. It took us a year, I should say, because, you know, I have an amazing filmmaking team. You know, this film is a labor of love, and for all the bad karma that Roger may have generated, you know, our filmmaking team was, you know, I thought of it like a karma offset, you know, like carbon offset. We were all good karma, you know, for all Roger's bad karma. So we had a great team, and we all, you know, we just, you know, worked long hours and tried to figure out ways to convince people that, you know, they had to talk to us. And, you know, Karen and Warren at Evergreen Partners were definitely those kind of people. Like, you know, they had an amazing story. They were with Roger right at the end when Gretchen sued.
Gretchen Carlson.
Gretchen Carlson sued. They walked into the room. You know, Roger was hooked up to an IV drip, you know, and he had his sort of cabal of enablers around him, and the phones are ringing off the hooks, and Giuliani's on and Dershowitz is on, and they're saying, you know, we're going to fucking take Gretchen Carlson down. That's it. She's out. You know, and these two people from the outside just walk into it and they don't know what to make of it. You know, it's like the madness is in full march, and they are two perfectly normal people who just sort of wander into it. And they told me this amazing story. I remember it exactly. And then they said, but we can't tell you that on camera, of course. And I was like, no, you have to. We made them videos of, like, we were like, well, you don't have to use your voice. We could just use a transcript and get someone else to read it. And then we got my cinematographer, it's called Charlotte Kaufman. She's also our associate producer. We got Charlotte's mum, Pat, who's awesome, to read the transcript of what they had said to us, because I'd been taking notes, you know, when they were on the phone. It was off the record, but, you know, this was just amongst us. So we got Pat to read their words and set it to kind of more abstract pictures and sent that to them and said, see, it looks great. Nobody ever has to know it's you. They still said no. And then I think, you know, the Me Too movement took off in a way that nobody could have predicted. And they felt like it wouldn't be the kiss of death to them professionally if they spoke about it, because society had sufficiently changed.
And had he passed away by the time you actually got them in front of the camera?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Because I was curious if his dying, because he died in spring of 2017, concurrent with you making the film. And I was curious if that made it, if people felt more free to speak about their experience with him, because you have people making very personal statements within the film about the way that he treated them, you know, in the recent past and in the distant past.
I think it definitely helped in terms of people's comfort levels that there was no longer a pressing legal reason why they shouldn't talk. In that Roger was litigious, and if Roger was no longer alive, then they were less likely to be sued. You know, that's the way it worked, I think.
Mm. And did you ever try and speak with him?
Well, we sent out an email via a mutual colleague, someone that he had known for a long time and trusted and who we had a good relationship with. And, you know, he died before we could really sort of get into it. But he knew we were making the film.
Interesting. But and did you get any response one way or the other?
No. And I sent out, you know, subsequently requests to Beth, his wife, and no response. Similarly to James Murdoch and to Irina Briganti at Fox and various other people at Fox. You know, you offer many people the opportunity to participate, and you know, it's they either turn you down or they don't reply at all. And I think the sort of feeling was that it was safe and just not to reply to me.
But you did have people from Fox in the production. I mean, they're
former employees.
Employees, I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I would love to talk a bit more about this circle of enablers, because it seems to me like, I mean, well, first of all, his story would be a fascinating story even if he hadn't also been a sexual harasser, and done all the things that he's alleged to have done. But he did do them, and I have this feeling that those two things are intertwined. You know, his power and his abuse of it. Mm-hmm. But one thing that was just so poignant in the film is that there was, and you just said it, the circle of people who made it possible for him to get away with the stuff that he got away with for so long.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the questions that we're, you know, constantly pursuing on this show is, how do we put an end to that? And yeah. I'm curious if you learned anything from any of the people who either were helping him or trying to stop the people who were helping him in terms of, you know, where does this get nipped in the bud so it doesn't become, you know, he started in his 20s and he continued to his 70s.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's harder today to get away with that kind of behavior. I think people are much more on guard for it. So I think it has changed. I don't know. I think, you know, things will change. When the pain of not doing something exceeds the pain of doing something, that's when people generally say something. You know, when they realize that, oh my God, if I don't say something, the fallout for this will be so terrible. It'll be such a mess. I have to say something. Because believe me, there's always going to be a pain associated with reporting sexual assault, both in terms of the person reporting it, because generally speaking, that's a woman, and generally speaking, it's not going to do any favors for their career. And, you know, for kind of the workplace environment that they're in, you know, for them to acknowledge it takes a lot, because they'd much rather ignore it. So I don't know whether there's been a real kind of philosophical shift or kind of ideological shift. I don't think we're there yet. You know, I look at the women who have been sexually assaulted or harassed at Fox, and, you know, none of them are working. And by the way, what's even worse is that, you know, some of them got a settlement from Fox. As part of their settlement, they have to sign not only an NDA that says, you know, they'll never talk about this again, which people know about, this kind of silencing thing, but that they will never apply to 21st Century Fox again in their lives, or any of its affiliates. So you have something terrible done to you, but you have to leave your job and you can't ever apply for a job there again or to any of its affiliates. And that is a signal to me that kind of the philosophy behind the corporation has not changed at all. You know, they pay people off, and yes, they say it's terrible that it happened, and, you know, we're taking good note of this and it shall never happen again. But, you know, if they really meant what they said, why not keep these women on? You know, all they want to do is work. And that's not uncommon. You know, when women report sexual harassment and sexual assault and can keep their jobs, I think that'll be a good signal that things are changing.
Right. Because right now it feels like the women are pushed to the side and the perpetrator is sort of paid off but still gets to keep working, and they're not necessarily banned.
I mean, sometimes they do, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. You know, Bill O'Reilly's not currently working. I'm sure he will rear his head up again. But there are men, you know, where the stigma is sufficient that they are not going to work again. You know, it's not like Charlie Rose has just jumped up with another job, or Matt Lauer or anything. You know, the stink of this is fairly stinky. So I do think that men are tarnished. But you know, that's not comparable to the women. The women had something done to them. You know, it's like being burgled and being told you have to move out of your house. It's like, why do I have to move out? I was the one who was burgled. You know, it's that. You know, frankly, I don't care what happens to the men. Let them reinvent themselves or not or whatever. But, you know, we've got to keep a focus on the women who are, you know, professional women, career women, you know, busting their chops, doing this stuff, and this ends up defining their lives, which is bad and wrong. They've got so much else going for them. You know, let it just be a blip, an unpleasant one, and get on with it.
Yeah. Well, that of the women that you spoke with, I was curious, with the whole conversation that's going on around now with, due process and, you know, men being unfairly accused, and how much did you feel like you needed to substantiate their claims? Because, you know, we know about Gretchen Carlson, yeah. We know about Megyn Kelly, but you talked to women who were not making headlines for the wrongs done unto them by Roger Ailes.
Yeah, we do always substantiate the claims. We do. You know, they're not, you know, nobody is in the room when these things happen. But if women told people at the time, that's a big sign. You know, if women, you know, that one woman in our film had been, you know, posting about this for years, you know, and being very open about what had happened to her with Roger, you know. So I just, you know, could she have been lying? Yeah, but she wasn't. It wouldn't have done her any favors. She wasn't getting any money. She didn't work for Fox. You know, it got her nothing. And she'd been, you know, telling this story, you know, for decades. So that to me, you know, says something.
Yeah. Is this the same woman that there was a story, one of the women told the story of being a huge fan of Roger Ailes and being so excited
right.
that her husband had set up a dinner with them. And
that's
then it
right.
all went sideways.
Yeah.
Is that the woman that you're talking
yes,
about?
Yes, that's the woman. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So did
she's
you...
got, yeah. She's got absolute... You've got to look at these situations of like, what have you got to gain, you know, by telling an untruth? You know, how is that going to bolster your position in life? And, you know, this kind of claim has only got the potential to tarnish you. You know, this was way before he was deposed, so he was a powerful man. You know, nobody listened to her. You know, that's the end. But, you know, it's feasible she could not have got jobs because of it. You know, going around and telling people that, you know, somebody is a, you know, behaved in a piggish way to you and did this and kind of, you know, it has no benefit to you whatsoever unless you happen to be on reality television.
Yeah, right. Did you speak with her husband? I kept thinking, oh my God, her husband made the introduction.
I didn't ask her husband about introducing them. I mean, I've spoken to him, but I didn't say, so how do you feel about you know, ushering Roger Ailes into your lives. I mean, everyone, you know, by all accounts, he was an incredibly successful mover and shaker. Yeah. You know, it's you shouldn't have to kind of do background checks on everyone you introduce your wife to, you know, or kind of sort of due diligence. He looked on paper to be, you know, very accomplished. He had good standing. He had, you know, good experience in his wife's professional career, you know, and in her area, and it was a good introduction, you know, if only he hadn't been, you know, such a pig.
Yeah. I'm Lauren Schiller. This is Inflection Point, stories of how women rise up. I'm speaking with Alexis Bloom, the director of Divide and Conquer, the story of Roger Ailes. Subscribe to the Inflection Point podcast and consider a contribution to help us continue to share more stories at inflectionpointradio.org. One of the other areas that I think we need to talk about is Roger Ailes' connection to Donald Trump and his role in his rise. But mostly I'm interested in the way that you depict Roger Ailes' behavior in this film and the way that he talked about the country and this theme of divide and conquer and you know, inciting outrage and stirring up the crazies. Mm-hmm. It seems like all of that is being epitomized by our current president, as if he'd been handed a playbook and was just literally reading out of it. Everything from even from the tape, the, you know, grab them by the private parts tape that came out right before the election seems to reflect the attitude of Roger Ailes. But then this theme of loyalty and, and creating division and tribalism.
I mean, the connection that you're talking about is, you know, is undisputable. How much of it is some macabre coincidence, I don't know. You know, because, they weren't raised side by side. It is a coincidence. You know, they just happened to float to the surface, you know, at the same time. But they were a great match in that, you know, Roger wanted viewers, wanted eyeballs. He knew that when Donald Trump went on Fox, that the viewership spiked upwards. He was an obsessive analyst of ratings, and ratings are done in 15-minute increments, and he could tell, you know, when, oh, you know, at 7:48 when Donald Trump came on, you know, up went the ratings. So he gave him a platform at Fox that nobody else had given him, to opine about politics, economics, immigration, you know, anything that Obama did, Donald Trump was brought on to talk about. You know, on all the big shows, on O'Reilly, on Hannity, he was a sort of political pundit on Fox, and he hadn't been that before. You know, he'd been a real estate mogul, you know, slash reality star, you know, bully boy, but he hadn't been a political commentator. And Roger gave him the opportunity to pivot into that role, into a bona fide political analyst, political commentator role. And that was invaluable to Donald Trump, and it did bring them close together. You know, when Roger Ailes got in trouble with Gretchen Carlson, who does he call? He calls Donald Trump. You know, I need a fixer. Who can fix this? They had a close relationship. They went to the baseball games and stuff together. Was Donald Trump Roger's first choice? No, because Roger had, as I said before, deep roots in the Republican Party, and he had a connection to the Bush family that goes back decades and decades, and I think he preferred Jeb Bush. But as soon as it became apparent that Jeb wasn't going to be a candidate, you know, that Chris Christie wasn't going to be a candidate, you know, Roger switched to Trump, and that was okay with him. I don't know how well they would have done today, because they both have such uncompromising egos. So one can only wonder how it would have played out. You know, there can only be one most powerful person in the room. And I think Roger and Donald would have, you know, had a lot of disagreements and sort of come to blows now.
What a just terrible symbiotic relationship.
I know. People you don't want to go on summer holiday with.
Oh, my goodness, no. Where did the film leave off? Because, the story of Roger Ailes continues even after his death, and Fox News is obviously still on the air. Where did you leave it, and is there kind of a postscript to where you've left it?
We left it with Donald Trump, you know, with Roger. You know, I think about it. I don't know whether this metaphor works in America, to be honest. You've got to tell me if it doesn't, if it just sounds bananas. But the king is dead. Long live the king.
Yeah, we get it.
You get it? Okay. You're like, we don't have a monarch here. That doesn't mean anything to us. I'm like, I'm sort of slightly scared to say it. But that's where the film, you know, leaves off, is the king is dead. Long live the king. Here we go. We've, you know, he might be dead, but we live with his... We live in his shadow and with his creation, Donald Trump. That's where it goes.
Yeah, and not just Donald Trump. I mean, just thinking about the way that people wanting to cause trouble, and maybe even countries wanting to cause trouble, are using the internet and building on these seeds of division and sowing discontent and turmoil, and just feeding off of that and growing it, and people's response to it.
Yeah.
Which maybe brings us back to Bhutan.
They're not very nice to their migrants, Bhutan, either. We can't all just go and move there because they have a problem with immigration and the Nepalese. They're not going to take us.
No. Well, what? I mean, so pausing for a moment to go back to Bhutan in the 90s, you know, where you did make your thesis film and were looking at what happened when TV entered their community and, you know, and wrestling was very exciting for them. Did you did you see an effect, a ripple effect? I mean, this is sort of an anthropological discussion in some ways. Yeah. Like, did you see a ripple effect on the community of that interjection of this other worldview into their peaceful community?
Yes, an explicit one. I mean, I'd love to go back and see how it's settled down now, you know, and how it's morphed. You know, at the time, it was just, you know, just slapped you in the face. It would, like, kids saying, well, it was an old granny saying, well, I didn't know that Colgate was the best toothpaste, but I'm really glad I watched TV because now I do. You know, and things like that, you were like, no, they're just telling you that. It's not necessarily the best toothpaste. You know, fashion changed. You know, it was the interjection of consumerism. And it was seen in a pretty, you know, uncritical light. Although I would say that the king and the kind of the monarchy in Bhutan was very aware of the potential ills of television. Once it came in, it was sort of all, it was just the floodgates opened and people, you know, consumed television in the way that you would had you never seen it before and were suddenly blasted with, you know, 40 channels, Baywatch, you know, wrestling and all the rest of it. You just never leave it. And they watched a lot of television.
Yeah. And the genie's out of the bottle in
Bhutan.
Genie's
out of the bottle.
And here.
Yeah, Baywatch is out of the bottle.
Yeah. I'm Lauren Schiller. This is Inflection Point, stories of how women rise up. I'm speaking with Alexis Bloom, the director of a new documentary called Divide and Conquer, The Story of Roger Ailes. Subscribe to the Inflection Point podcast at inflectionpointradio.org. And while you're there, consider a contribution to help us continue to share more stories. I'm Lauren Schiller. This is Inflection Point, stories of how women rise up. I'm speaking with Alexis Bloom, the director of the new documentary, Divide and Conquer, The Story of Roger Ailes. To me, it's just so fascinating the role of media on our culture and what signals media sends to all of us about how we're supposed to behave and what is appropriate behavior and even just, you know, if you look at the history of entertainment, you know, since the invention of movies and then television and so on, the way that men and women are portrayed and the way that we think the genders are supposed to, you know, act towards each other. And, you know, and Fox News is just one more iteration of how we're supposed to act towards each other.
Oh, Lord save us.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, I don't know what you look like, but I hope it's not in one of those jewel-colored dresses, you know, with your cleavage. Do you do that on the radio?
I'm sitting
you
here.
Should.
I've got
make an effort, woman. Make an effort.
I've got my desk has a clear bottom so that when I wear my short skirt, you can see my hot legs. That is totally
great.
How we roll here.
Good.
At the station. Yeah. Aren't you?
Yeah. Definitely. In fact, I did this whole film in a bikini. Yeah. And that's why nobody talked to me.
Oh my gosh. If we can't laugh, I mean, really, what can
I
we
mean,
do?
I mean, that you do, you have to. I mean, it's very serious and I'm engaged in it in a hugely serious way. And I took like a long chunk of my time, you know, my life to do this. But you have to laugh. It's the only thing that's going to keep us sane. You know, it really is. And then you have to kind of get off your ass and do something about it, you know, and be outspoken. It's kind of, yeah, I mean, it's really, it's unacceptable the way, oh, I don't know, the way women look on Fox. To me, it is. And I don't mean to insult them. And I'm sure that, you know, it's all consensual. I know it is. But it has objectified women to a degree that I personally find regressive. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, wasn't there, there's a quote. I've read so much about the film and I've seen the film, so I can't remember where the quote came from, but it's but somebody said that being a woman at Fox News was like being a stripper but with glossier poles.
Roger said that. Ah! Roger Ailes said that. Yeah.
That's just disgusting.
Yeah.
And then to work there.
I know, but, you know, Alison Camerota, who's at CNN, worked there for 16 years. She is one of the sanest people I know and exquisitely, fiercely intelligent about human nature. I don't know how she stayed there for 16 years, but she did. She did good work there, actually, because I've sort of seen a lot of her archive. I've seen a lot of everyone's archive. But, like, she isn't prone to saying kind of Santa is white type comment. And she... You know, she got paid money and she did her work and she got out of there. So there are people, you know, it's not kind of all kind of aliens have stolen my brain. There are real human beings who work there and a lot of Democrats who work there, by the way, because, you know, try staffing a news organization in New York City and only hiring Republicans. You just would have the smallest, you know, news station in the whole world. It'd be three people.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess I should admit that, you know, by saying it's disgusting, I don't know how they can work there sounds very judgy and, you know, just as objectifying as asking someone to sit at a desk with no, you know, bottom.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. And then we get into this whole thing of like, can we not say what we mean anymore? It is a bit judgy, but that's okay because, frankly, we should have a discussion about what makes your value as a woman. You know, what is it that speaks to your power? And certainly the women on Fox can talk and articulate, and certainly many of them are bright. But there is, you know, a scenario, and it's not everyone, because, by the way, they're all occasionally, like, someone who isn't devastatingly attractive slips through the net. You know, they are then given by the Fox makeover where their hair is poofed out by 200 feet and, you know, lashings of makeup. But for me, it is like, you know, is there worth in how they look? And it's not a crime to say that, you know, it's not a crime to say I wouldn't do that. You know, I just wouldn't. I wouldn't do that.
Where did you get, for lack of a better term, your sense of self or your sense of worth? I mean, how has that been instilled in you?
Probably, I don't know. I mean, you know, big family, probably last of six kids doesn't hurt. You know, you have to. You know, nobody cares what you look like, really, the last of six kids. I don't know.
Get all the hand-me-downs.
I don't know. Yeah, you know, I don't know. I'm lucky, you know, I have a large, you know, pluralistic family. We've been, you know, moved around. I was born in South Africa, went to England, then had to, you know, then came here. And I feel like, you know... You notice more sometimes when you move around a lot, and you notice, I feel like I know what's important in the long run, you know, and a sense of humor is important in the long run, and, you know, an ability to, you know, understand the scaffolding you live in is important in the long run. You might not be able to change it, or, you know, you might always dislike it, but at least if you understand it, you can get over it a bit. I don't know. There's other traits I see as important, and I don't know, you know, nobody ever offered me, you know, a jewel coloured dress. I don't know. Maybe, you know what, it's probably a terrible burden coming out that fantastically good looking. Because, you know, the male people, the male population who, by the way, make jobs happen, put you in those roles. And what are you going to say? No, I don't want to work. You know, it's tough.
Hmm. Well, what, I mean, you're working in this very industry, you know, that we've been talking about, where the Me Too movement has had its, you know, largest appearance, you know, mm-hmm. media and film and so on. And, you strike me as someone who would take no crap, but I'm curious. I mean, have you run into this yourself and had to deal with it?
I have. I've been really lucky. I haven't run into a situation where it's been, you know, you either sleep with me or leave the company. I've never had that quid pro quo. I've never had a situation where, you know, it's damaged my career in a long-lasting way. I've certainly had people make inappropriate advances to me. Yeah, I have. But, yeah, I have. But most women have. And I'm just fortunate that, you know, I was able to deal with it at the time and move on. They weren't so traumatic that I was not able to move on. You know, I know that I'm kind of a lucky person in that sense.
Yeah, that's been my experience too. And one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about are how we as individuals, what our makeup is, not our what we're wearing, but like our psychological makeup is.
mm-hmm.
That allows us to, you know, and this, every situation is different, but allows us to say that was terrible and now I'm moving on versus that was terrible and now I'm going to let it fester for 20 years and, you know, come out about it. Because the person that did it is now famous. And, I don't really know what to make of it one way or the other, but I'm just throwing it out there as something that has been making me curious.
Yeah, it's curious. And these are really interesting, tricky subjects. And we've got to, you know, dig deep. You know, we do. These are things that are worth grappling with and understanding. You know, it can't be an atmosphere where it's the guillotine for saying something that's not currently fashionable or acceptable or politically correct. You know, there are some women who are able to. I mean, Kelly Boyle is a case in point, who's in our film, you know, who Roger made a pass at and said, you know, if you want to play with the big boys, you've got to lay with the big boys. She grew up on top of a bar. You know, working class family, grew up on top of a bar and was used to men making passes at her. And she's pretty tough. And she was like, you know, I've been dealing with this my whole life. It was awful. She said, I'm not underplaying it. It was awful. I'm in the back of the car with this guy and he's making this pass at me and I've admired him and it's come out of nowhere and it's full on and it's vulgar and it's explicit and he's got me alone and like I don't want to like create a scene or a tussle or like have to fight him off in the back seat. So it's pretty bad. But then she gets out of the car and she goes, oh, thank God, that's over with. I never have to see him again. Where it then gets so dark is that he calls up the people that she is interviewing with and says, you know, she's on a do not hire list. You know, he takes that extra punitive step of, you're not going to welcome my advances. This is where you're going to end up. You know, that to me is unspeakable. You know, men will always make inappropriate advances at women. Appropriate, inappropriate. It's quite hard to know sometimes which is which and which is welcome and not. And, you know, I don't know, you're in a bar, there's alcohol involved. I mean, obviously in the workplace, I would say general rule, try not to shtup anyone in the workplace because it doesn't end well. Although, by the way, that's where lots of people meet their partners. But, you know, yeah. It's hard to, I mean, you know, publish the handbook that says what's an appropriate advance and what isn't. I mean, you know, I'd love to read it.
Yeah. Or maybe the handbook is just simply what's an appropriate response to a response to an advance. You know, like he didn't have to go and do that extra thing. She was ready to move on. But,
yeah.
You know. So.
Yeah. When someone says no, what do you do next?
Yeah.
And I'd say just
right.
Back away from the vehicle. Yeah.
What is the best advice that you've ever been given about how to say what you think?
The best advice was, you know, dignity. Say it with dignity, you know, and that encompasses many things. If you speak up, you know, say it firmly, say it in a tone that isn't overly emotional, say it directly. You know, I think dignity encompasses so many kind of different things. And I'd say that was that, you know, it sort of implies a hold your head up kind of thing. And I would advise my daughter, I have a daughter, you know, to, if she wants to be heard, just say it with dignity.
That was the dignified Alexis Bloom, the director of the documentary Divide and Conquer, the story of Roger Ailes. The film ends with a few statistics about the millions of dollars that have been paid out to silence women who were sexually harassed and assaulted while working at Fox News, and to legally bind them never to work for Fox or any of its affiliates again. As a reminder, these women spoke up well before the Me Too movement took off. And as we learn in the film, Ailes had other women and some highly paid lawyers who stood by him through it all. The story of Roger Ailes' rise to power and eventual downfall is the story of enablers, people who are willing to look the other way when a predator abuses people, and who are willing to step in and muzzle the victims he leaves in his wake. This story is still happening every day. The film is out now in theaters as well as on-demand streaming platforms. We'll put a link to where to find it, as well as the trailer, at inflectionpointradio.org. I'm Lauren Schiller, and this is Inflection Point. That's our Inflection Point for today. All of our episodes are on Apple Podcasts, Radio Public, Stitcher, and NPR One. Give us a 5-star review and subscribe to the podcast. Know a woman with a great rising up story? Let us know at inflectionpointradio.org. While you're there, I invite you to support Inflection Point with a monthly or one-time contribution. Your support keeps women's stories front and center. Just go to inflectionpointradio.org. We're on Facebook at Inflection Point Radio. Follow us and follow me on Twitter at L.A. Schiller. To find out more about the guests you heard today and to sign up for our email newsletter, you know where to go, inflectionpointradio.org. Inflection Point is produced in partnership with KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco and PRX. Our story editor and content manager is Alora Weaver. Our engineer and producer is Eric Wayne. I'm your host, Lauren Schiller.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.